marked a promising turning point as Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the state's infection rate has remained below 1% for 30 straight days. An estimated 250,000 infections from August 2nd to September 2nd, or one-fifth of the newly reported cases in the United States during that time, can be traced back to a South Dakota motorcycle rally, according to a San Diego State University paper. U.S. stocks took a nosedive for the third straight day of trading, with Tuesday's market open. Tech shares were positioned for losses again after last week's sell-off that snapped Wall Street's five-week win streak. India surpassed Brazil to become the country with the second highest number of coronavirus cases in the world, behind only the United States. U.S. federal officials have cast skepticism on President Trump's predictions that a coronavirus vaccine could be available to Americans by Election Day. Here are some short articles. Texas governor extends COVID-19 disaster declaration. Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued a proclamation extending the disaster declaration for all counties in the state in response to COVID-19. The extension was signed on Monday. The original proclamation was issued on March 13th and has been renewed on a monthly basis since. Renewing this disaster declaration helps ensure that we have the resources and strategies in place to help communities across Texas respond to COVID-19, Abbott said in a statement. I urge Texans to take precautionary steps to protect their health by wearing a mask, social distancing, and sanitizing their hands. Working together, we will slow the spread and keep our communities safe. What's reopening this week? Kids are going back to school, and the NFL season will kick off. The U.S. has recorded more than 6.3 million cases of the virus since the pandemic began earlier this year, according to the latest tally from Johns Hopkins University. But today, the day after Labor Day in the U.S. and the unofficial start of fall, some hallmarks of fall and other businesses are starting to reopen. Here's a look at some of the things that are reopening this week or recently opened their doors again. Schools. Many students across the country are going back today. 16 of the nation's largest 101 districts are starting the school year today, including those in Chicago, Houston Independent School District, and Dallas Independent School District. Of the 16 districts, 14 of them are beginning their year entirely online. One district, Cypress Fairbanks in Texas, is opening either all online or all in person, with parents choosing which plan they'd like. And another one, Charleston, South Carolina, is opening with a hybrid plan. Professional football. The National Football League will have its season opener on Thursday when the Kansas City Chiefs will begin their Super Bowl title defense against the Houston Texans. Last month, the Chiefs announced it was planning to have approximately 22% of Arrowhead Stadium's 76,000 seats filled for the opener. Movies. Last week, AMC said that 70% of its theaters, or 420 total, would be open by this weekend, including the first AMC theater in San Diego, California. The weekend also saw the release of Tenet, which brought in an estimated $20.2 million domestically this weekend. New challenges in U.S. battle against COVID-19 come with the approaching fall season. Ahead of Labor Day this year, health officials warned that how Americans chose to ring in the unofficial start of fall could shape what the next months in the country's battle against COVID-19 will look like. The holiday crowds mark the unofficial end to a devastating summer across the country, with COVID-19 infections surging to more than 6.3 million and deaths topping 189,000. Experts have offered a grim prediction on what the fall and winter could look like, with the pandemic stacking up against flu season and new fronts opening up, including schools and college campuses. We're heading into a more difficult season, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former U.S. Food and Drug Administration commissioner, said on CBS's Face the Nation. We're heading into the fall and the winter, when we would expect a respiratory pathogen like a coronavirus to start spreading more aggressively than it would in the summertime. New challenges ahead. With cooler weather ahead, it's likely many of the gatherings that have already been taking place, many against experts' advice, will now move indoors, where health officials have said the virus can spread more easily. Masks. Months into the pandemic, safety measures like face masks remain a point of contention nationwide, despite experts' projections that more mask wearing could mean thousands of lives saved by the end of the year. Campuses and schools. With tens of thousands of students back on campus, institutions are facing massive challenges. COVID-19 cases in colleges have been linked back to activities including athletics, off-campus gatherings, and Greek life. Experts project autumn surge in coronavirus cases with a peak after Election Day. Infectious disease experts are warning of a potential cold weather surge of coronavirus cases, a long-feared second wave of infections and deaths, possibly at a catastrophic scale. It could begin well before Election Day, November 3rd, although researchers assume the crest would come weeks later, closer to when fall gives way to winter. An autumn surge in COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, would not be an October surprise. It has been hypothesized since early in the pandemic because of the patterns of other respiratory viruses. The pandemic is already a dominant campaign issue, and it's not clear that even a spike in deaths would apply much torque to the presidential race. Outbreaks in some states could also bring pressure further down the ballot and conceivably affect turnout if there is so much community spread that voters who planned to cast ballots in person feel unsafe going to the polls. A bad flu season colliding with the coronavirus pandemic could be overwhelming. Doctors and health officials are urging Americans to get vaccinated against influenza in record numbers this fall to avoid a dreaded scenario: flu colliding with the raging coronavirus pandemic. They worry that tens of millions of flu-related illnesses could overwhelm hospitals, doctors' offices, and laboratories that test for both respiratory illnesses. Symptoms of flu and COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronaviruses, are similar. When someone presents to a physician with fever, cough, malaise, unless it's one of the few things peculiar to COVID-19, like a loss of smell, it's hard to tell them apart when both are circulating in the community, said Benjamin D. Singer, an assistant professor of medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and a pulmonary critical care specialist at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Now, here are a couple of related short stories. This might be your most important flu shot ever. Getting a flu shot is a safe, inexpensive way to stay healthy. But in a typical year, less than half of Americans get the vaccination, just 45% last year. Rates in the United Kingdom are comparable, where just 44.9% of registered patients ages 6 months to 64 years old got a flu vaccination from 2018 to 2019. In the European Union, which committed in 2009 to vaccinate at least 75% of residents ages 65 and older, only 45% of people in that group received vaccines in 2018. The number is even lower for people of color, who have been especially vulnerable during the pandemic. In the 2017 to 2018 flu season, just 28.4% of Hispanic people in the United States got vaccinations against influenza. With the COVID-19 pandemic spreading rapidly around the globe, distributing the flu vaccine takes on new urgency, according to medical experts. Since hospitals and doctors' offices are going to be very busy caring for COVID-19 patients, a flu vaccine can help decrease burdens on the healthcare system and make sure that those who need medical care are able to get it, said Dr. Susan Bailey, president of the American Medical Association and an immunologist in Fort Worth. It's not just to free up resources for COVID-19 patients, though. Influenza is a deadly disease in its own right, Bailey said. And because flu symptoms, including fever, sore throat, and cough, look so similar to COVID-19 symptoms, it will be impossible to rule out a coronavirus diagnosis without a test. That means a case of the flu, even if it turns out to be mild, can cause substantial disruption to work and school. Telling the difference between flu and coronavirus is essential to treatment. About a week before Pennsylvania shut down last March, at the start of the pandemic, Amanda Bernstein felt short of breath. Then she had a dry cough, followed by a fever. Bernstein, a 29-year-old insurance analyst, asked for a coronavirus test, but her doctor said he didn't have one. Instead, he tested her for influenza. When that came back negative, he said she probably had a bug, and indeed she was fine after a few days of Tylenol and cough syrup. I'll never know if I had COVID, Bernstein said. If I'd known more back then about how serious it was, I'd have been much more worried. 6 months later, on the verge of another flu season, Americans know a lot more about COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. Vaccine developers deemed it critical to reiterate their commitment to ethics, Pfizer CEO said. The vaccine developers involved in the pledge to maintain high ethical standards for vaccines felt the need to reiterate their commitment to high ethical standards and scientific processes, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said on NBC's Today show on Tuesday. With increasing public concerns about the processes we are using to develop these vaccines, and even more importantly, the processes that will be used to evaluate these vaccines, we saw it as critical to come out and reiterate our commitment that we will develop our products, our vaccines, using the highest ethical standards and the most scientific, rigorous processes, Bourla said. The nine vaccine makers said they will stand with science at a time when the world is looking to science, in particular to a vaccine, to help bring us to the end of the pandemic, Bourla said. The only rival here is the virus, and it's time to get the vaccine to this, Bourla said. He called the pledge between nine vaccine makers historic and an unprecedented moment. Pfizer BioNTech vaccine could be ready for approval by mid-October, but there are still unknowns. Pfizer and BioNTech are confident they can have a vaccine against the novel coronavirus ready for regulatory approval by the middle of October, BioNTech CEO and co-founder Uğur Şahin has told CNN. It has an excellent profile, and I consider this vaccine near perfect, and which has a near perfect profile, Şahin said in an exclusive interview with CNN. He added that the company's understanding of the mode of action, in combination with the safety data coming in from the running trial, meant that they have a lot of confidence in it. Yes, we believe that we have a safe product, and we believe that we will be able to show efficacy, he said. Şahin told CNN he believes that approval for emergency use will be granted quickly by regulatory authorities. U.S. drug giant Pfizer and German firm BioNTech say they plan to provide 100 million doses of their vaccine candidate, BNT162, by the end of the year, and up to 1.3 billion doses in 2021. Another federal official raises questions about Trump's vaccine timeline. Another federal official is making it clear that despite U.S. President Donald Trump's predictions, there's hardly any chance a vaccine will be available to Americans by Election Day. I don't know any scientist involved in this effort who thinks we will be getting shots into arms anytime before Election Day, said the official, who is familiar with Operation Warp Speed, the federal government's effort to develop coronavirus vaccines. Trump, however, has projected optimism for a quicker timeline. It's going to be done in a very short period of time. Could even have it during the month of October, the president said at a press briefing Monday. We'll have the vaccine soon, maybe before a special date, You know the date I'm talking about. On August 6th, Trump said he was optimistic a vaccine would be ready by around November 3rd. I believe we'll have the vaccine before the end of the year, certainly, but around that date, yes, I think so, Trump said. And at a rally last week, he said, it will be delivered before the end of the year. In my opinion, before the end of the year. But it really might even be delivered before the end of October. The federal official is not the first to cast skepticism on Trump's forecast. It's extremely unlikely, but not impossible, that a COVID-19 vaccine could be authorized for emergency use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration before the end of October. Moncef Slaoui, the chief advisor to Operation Warp Speed, told NPR last week. Dr. Larry Corey, who's leading a group set up by the National Institutes of Health to work on coronavirus vaccines, also said he doesn't think there will be a vaccine available by Election Day. I would agree with Dr. Slaoui. The chances are very low, very remote, said Corey, who leads the COVID-19 Prevention Network. Senate could vote on slimmed-down stimulus bill as soon as this week, McConnell says. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that he will introduce the new Republican scaled-back stimulus plan on Tuesday, acknowledging the bill does not have everything that Republicans want in it. It does not contain every idea our party likes, McConnell said in a statement. I am confident Democrats will feel the same. Yet Republicans believe the many serious differences between our two parties should not stand in the way of agreeing where we can agree and making law that helps our nation. What happens next? A procedural vote to bring up the plan could happen as soon as this week, McConnell said. 60 votes would be needed to overcome the Democratic filibuster and advance the proposal, and the plan is far short of securing the necessary votes. CNN also reported earlier this morning that Republicans privately acknowledge they have not yet won the backing of 51 of their members for their party's stimulus proposal. This comes after McConnell offered a $1 trillion plan in July, but Republicans were badly divided over that proposal, and he never brought that plan up for a vote. Now here are a couple of practical stories. These are shorter articles. It's highly unlikely that food is a source of COVID-19 contamination, experts say. A team of experts on food contamination says it's highly unlikely that food is a source of COVID-19 transmission. The International Commission on Microbiological Specifications for Foods, ICMSF, looked at the evidence that coronavirus might be carried on food or its packaging and found very little. Their finding mirrors earlier reporting from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that there is no real risk of getting the virus that causes COVID-19 from food or food packaging. To date, there has not been any evidence that food, food packaging, or food handling is a source of important transmission route for SARS-CoV-2 resulting in COVID-19, the organization said in a statement. There are no foods that should be considered a risk or warrant consideration as a vector for SARS-CoV-2. While it is possible that people could eat something contaminated with the virus and become infected that way, it's never been seen to have happened, they said. However, it is still prudent to emphasize good food hygiene practices, the group said. Deep cleans might not keep us from getting the virus, but they sure make us feel better. No one is touching anything, and everyone is cleaning everything. Despite initial reports warning people that the novel coronavirus can be transmitted from contaminated surfaces, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has told Americans in no uncertain terms that the virus is primarily transmitted person to person through breathing, speaking, shouting, and singing. While it may be possible to catch the coronavirus from a doorknob or a package, it's a long shot and not thought to be the main way the virus spreads, says the agency. It still recommends disinfecting high-touch surfaces. Yet, 6 months into the pandemic, Americans seem determined to Clorox their way into absolution. They're wiping down soccer balls, Lysoling beach chairs, touching pen pads with touch tools and gloves, and cleaning bags of Tostitos with diluted bleach. I'm going to now read two longer articles, both of these from the Washington Post. For women and children around the world, a double plague, coronavirus and domestic violence. Zoila fell fast for the soft-spoken day laborer, moving in with him last year just 2 weeks after their first date. But after El Salvador imposed a strict coronavirus lockdown, she says the man she thought she knew became an inescapable menace. The quarantine changed everything, she said. Shut inside their one-room house in rural El Salvador, he began drinking heavily. Soon, she says, he was regularly violating the coronavirus curfew and seeing other women openly. He would return home at odd hours, wake her, and demand meals. Drunk, he would taunt Zoila, 24 years old and pregnant, calling her worthless and threatening violence. Then one morning, she says, he grabbed her by the throat, slammed her against the wall, and attempted to rape her. When she resisted, she said, the punching began, stopping only when fluid began trailing down her leg. Zoila screamed, fearing a miscarriage. I remember that day, and I just want to cry, said Zoila, who gave birth to a daughter in June. To protect their identities, the Washington Post is only using the first names of Zoila and Sandley, another woman who says she has been abused during the pandemic. I was pregnant, Zoila said. During what was supposed to be a time of joy for me, I felt only pain. For untold numbers of women and children around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic has meant a twofold threat: the risk of catching a deadly virus, coupled with the peril of being locked in confined spaces with increasingly violent abusers. Official statistics are mixed. In some countries, reports of abuse have risen during the pandemic. In others, including the United States, they've fallen. But people who work with victims say that in countries seeing fewer complaints, the numbers mask a darker reality. The closure of schools and daycare centers means teachers and social workers have been unable to identify and report abuse. A growing body of evidence suggests incidents of domestic violence are rising as families struggle with restrictions on movement and mounting economic hardship. Countries rich and poor have shown growing signs of a surge in domestic violence. 54% of vulnerable women surveyed by CARE in Lebanon reported an increase in violence and harassment during the pandemic. 44% said they felt less safe at home. In China's Hubei province, domestic violence reports to police more than tripled during the lockdown there in February. Then French Interior Minister Christophe Castaner said reports of domestic violence jumped by more than 30% within the first 2 weeks of the country's lockdown. The Catalan regional government of Spain reported a 20% increase in calls to its helpline in the first few days of its confinement order, according to UNICEF. There is precedent for increased abuse during health crises. During the 2014 Ebola outbreak in Africa, researchers with UNICEF and major charities found violence against children, rapes, and teenage pregnancies all spiked. Sometimes reported abuse cases are falling dramatically, and you would think that violence is going down, but it's just the opposite, said Christina Weggs, the Global Advocacy Director for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights for CARE. The drop is reflecting that women and vulnerable people are not able to report what's happening. You see this in times of crisis. Abuse goes up as there are incredible strains on families and people are confined together without choice. The Post was unable to confirm individual accounts of abuse independently. The women who spoke to the Post for this article also shared their stories with organizations that work with victims. The data is particularly troubling in Latin America. In Colombia, intrafamily violence against women ages 29 to 59 spiked 94% between March and May, a study showed. Officials in Paraguay received reports of at least 80 abuse cases a day in March, a 35% jump from the same month a year earlier. In the Venezuelan state of Táchira, local officials responded to 840 cases of abuse from March through May, up from 150 cases during the same period a year earlier. In Buenos Aires, calls to an emergency hotline for abuse cases spiked 48% from March through June year over year. Some young victims, unable to access teachers or counselors while locked down, have sought new ways to find help. Sarah Barney, head of Red Viva, an anti-abuse organization in Buenos Aires, was going through the group's Facebook messages when she spotted what she called an SOS from a 14-year-old boy. "We didn't used to get calls for help like this," she said, "but we're seeing it happen more during the quarantine." She reviewed videos and audio recordings sent by the boy. He could be heard screaming as an uncle physically and verbally abused him and sexually abused his younger sister. "He sent me a video, a very short one, showing how his uncle touched his 5-year-old sister," Barney said. "It was sickening." She contacted Argentine authorities, she said, and several days later, police found the boy and his two sisters and removed them from the abusive home. "I couldn't believe how brave and quick-thinking this young boy was," she said. "I am sure that once this lockdown is over, we will discover there was a dark side to this pandemic. The stress and close quarters produced by the pandemic can be a trigger for aggression." Sandley, a 45-year-old school principal in Venezuela, said she endured years of violence from her husband early in their marriage, but 5 years had passed since he last struck her, and she had begun to think they had turned a corner. "I think he was trying to change," she said. Then the novel coronavirus hit the region. She tested positive and was forced into official quarantine at a hotel, leaving her husband to care for their 8-year-old granddaughter at home. "He grew resentful," she said. "He started texting me, sounding more violent," she said. "He went from not doing anything in the house to being the one in charge of food, cleaning, and cooking. He kept blaming me for what happened, saying he was not meant to do that kind of work. He said it was all my fault." When she returned home from quarantine, she said the apparent self-control he had shown over the past 5 years had vanished. At first, she said, it was words. He would threaten to kill her. By June, she said, she was receiving regular beatings. At one point, he towered over her with a machete, threatening to hack her, according to a copy of the official complaint she lodged with the prosecutor's office. She grew more afraid when she started finding him sitting in the dark, brooding, staring at her with menace as she moved around the room. She packed what she could into two knapsacks emblazoned with the Venezuelan flag. She took her granddaughter's hand and slipped out of the house while he was not there, fleeing to a safe house set up by a charity. "I closed the door behind me," she said. "I never looked back." Now, here is another article. Diagnosis for small family doctors: less money, greater hardship, and patients on video. Government loans and a shift to telehealth have plugged holes, but deep worries plague independent practices. The wedding band is gone. So are his class ring, his wristwatch, the neckties he has worn for decades, even the white coat with his name embroidered in blue. Since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, James W. McNabb has switched to wearing just surgical scrubs. It's a departure from the Norman Rockwell image of a small-town doctor, depicted in a print hanging at McNabb's small-town practice in Mooresville, North Carolina. But the stripped-down look leaves fewer places for coronavirus to hide. The staff disinfects the office 5 times a day. The waiting room magazines have all been tossed out, eliminating another route of infection. McNabb says these are just some of the permanent changes the coronavirus has wrought on his practice. For many solo practitioners, the virus has forced a stark choice: adapt or shut down. Doctors who have been scrambling to stay afloat are changing the way they interact with patients and the way they run their businesses, and many changes are expected to be lasting. Doctors are shifting large portions of their patients to virtual telehealth visits. They are being forced to make do with less revenue, some of which may never come back. Medical associations say some doctors are retiring early or joining larger groups as they seek strength in numbers. And with the episodic fee-for-service payment system magnifying economic pain for doctors as patients shun medical care amid the pandemic, the coronavirus crisis also may be accelerating long-overdue changes in the way doctors are paid, specialists said. Like his colleagues across the country, many of whom operate like small businesses, McNabb is working with less pay and a shrinking staff, all while scrambling to connect with patients on the internet and making diagnoses over laptops and smartphones. "I sink or swim, depending on my revenue," he said. "There is no salary. You eat what you kill, and you're not bringing any money in. You're not taking any money home." National surveys have shown that independent primary care doctors already were squeezed financially. Compensation for family doctors is among the lowest in medicine, especially for independent physicians in rural areas who can barely afford to keep their exam rooms open to see patients they have treated for decades. The virus has forced a sudden and devastating cut in patient visits in March as people heeded public health warnings and stopped venturing out. That in turn led to an immediate cash crisis for doctors that has put the entire country's healthcare system under extreme financial pressure. Predictably, many of the doctors at the bottom, the ones who form the backbone of frontline care, are barely hanging on. For primary care doctors, the coronavirus is an extinction-level event that requires a stronger policy response from government and insurance companies, said Rebecca Etz, co-director of the Larry A. Green Center, a nonprofit organization based at Virginia Commonwealth University that advocates for stronger supports for primary medicine. "After COVID, everything about healthcare is just going to be completely different," Etz said. "We know the pandemic is not going to let us get back to normal for at least a year, and there is no normal to go back to." In addition to the physical crisis, doctors are juggling more work because of layoffs or staffers who quit, coping with chronic shortages of masks and other personal protective equipment, and struggling to keep track of chronically ill elderly people who are afraid to leave their homes. Crucial side revenue from things such as in-office tests and x-rays have completely dried up. Responses to a questionnaire in August circulated by the nonprofit Physicians Foundation suggested about 8% of U.S. doctors who reported shuttering their practice because of the coronavirus, or up to 4,000 practitioners, were primary care physicians. About 486,000 doctors work in all categories of primary care in the United States, including family doctors, internists, obstetricians, and pediatricians, according to data compiled by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Many doctors have stayed in business by skipping their own paychecks or reducing their salaries and furloughing members of their small teams. But critics say outdated methods of payment have compounded the crisis and heightened the urgency of moving away from episodic fee-for-service contracts between providers and insurance companies and toward a more holistic billing approach. "COVID, I think, has exposed everything that is wrong with the healthcare system," said Greg Griggs, executive vice president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. "You have these financial challenges. You have higher costs, and you have logistical challenges. All combined are pretty much a nightmare for primary care practices. Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, loans, approved by Congress and the Trump administration, kept doctors afloat in the depths of the crisis from April through June. But the effect of that federal support is now evaporating, while patient visits and billings have yet to fully rebound. And those visits and billings may never return. Responses to a questionnaire from the Green Center and another nonprofit, the Primary Care Collaborative, indicated that 4 out of 5 primary care doctors were under greater levels of stress in July than they were in March. 44% of doctors who answered the questionnaire said in-person patient visits in July were 30 to 50% lower than normal. And moving from in-person visits to video examinations has been a stopgap at best, the group said. Although telehealth has proven a useful care tool during the pandemic, lack of sufficient support has resulted in a downturn in use and a choke point for patient access, the group said of the questionnaire's findings. The Trump administration permitted Medicare to make full doctor payments for telehealth visits under the COVID-19 public health emergency, and President Trump has proposed making the changes permanent for rural providers. Private insurance companies, while they have temporarily boosted payments to doctors to conduct remote examinations, have not committed to a permanent change. In the short term, telehealth has been a vital link in the crisis, doctors said. Physicians turned on a dime and began seeing most of their patients via video link. In almost 40 years of practice, I've never had a situation where I told patients they couldn't come in, said Mitchell Miller, a solo practitioner in Virginia Beach. Patients feel a bit more comfortable seeing us on the screen as opposed to sitting 1 foot away. There was a learning curve initially. It was pretty maddening at first, frankly, he said, but most patients were able to adapt with coaching from the office staff. For those who couldn't, Miller and his small team made do with telephone consultations. Miller estimates he has lost about $150,000 in patient revenue in the first 5 months of the pandemic. Patient revenue was about one-third of normal levels in March and April and rose to about 70% by July, he said. Much of his losses were plagued by a PPP loan of $130,000, but that federal assistance has been used up. The number of patients has bounced back somewhat, but not to pre-outbreak levels, he said. One day, maybe a year from now, we will have life as it used to be, he said. But I'm not sure we're going to see it. Independent practitioners have faced another crippling problem, an inability to purchase personal protective equipment. Without it, they have been unable to see patients with suspected COVID-19 in person. At Temescal Creek Medicine, a two-physician practice in Oakland, California, Michael Zimmerman said the office could not offer testing. Instead, it spoke with patients via video or telephone to determine whether they were sick enough to go to an emergency room to seek a test. I literally had black paint on my N95 mask because I was using the one from my garage, Zimmerman said. But by last month, a California Association of Doctors had started a program to distribute boxes of 100 masks to independent doctors who lacked the purchasing power to get them on their own. Zimmerman pulled up to a pickup site, and young volunteers dropped the box in his trunk. I was almost tearful when I got this thing, he said. It was the first time I changed my mask since March 15th. The flow of patients coming in for primary care visits has improved in the past 2 months, doctors said. But the crisis has driven some small independent family physicians to close up shop or join larger groups, a kind of strength-in-numbers approach that yields higher reimbursements because big groups have more negotiating leverage with insurance companies. For-profit companies, backed by private equity investors, have been rolling up practices in the most lucrative markets for years. In Texas, A nonprofit physician group called Catalyst Health Network says it offers an alternative that permits physicians to retain their independence while getting the benefits of belonging to a large group, with large teams and plenty of administrative support. Catalyst's helped its doctors apply for PPP loans, and it set up drive-through coronavirus testing centers where doctors could send their patients. The group has added hundreds of doctors, growing to 1,000 since the pandemic began, and has a deep list of more ready to sign up, said Catalyst Chief Executive Christopher Crow. Michelle Forbes, a pediatrician whose practice north of Dallas is part of Catalyst, helps recruit doctors to join the network. The muscle of 1,000 doctors is a huge part of the draw, she said, because it creates incentive for large insurance companies to compensate the group more fully for all of the work it does to keep patients healthy. Why don't we recognize the value of primary care? Forbes said. Primary care is not sexy. It's the gritty. It's the granular. It's what I do to keep my patient healthy and address their chronic issues and social issues and housing security and education. And it can be hard work. Advocates for overhauling payment practices and health care hope the crisis will steer contracts between insurance companies and doctors away from fee-for-service agreements that make the office visit the primary driver of payments for family doctors and pediatricians. Instead, they argue insurers should pay providers an upfront fee to manage a patient's health for the duration of the coronavirus crisis. Providers would receive more money for people with chronic disease and would be financially incentivized to keep people healthy and out of the hospital. The need to move toward such contracts, called prospective or capitated payments, has been debated for years. Family medicine has politely whispered for years that fee-for-service was an illogical payment construct for primary care. Sean Martin, chief executive of the American Academy of Family Physicians, wrote in an April blog post. And the COVID-19 pandemic simply put a giant spotlight on this issue. I'm going to read two more articles about how things may change after COVID-19. COVID-19 school disruption could affect economies for the rest of the 21st century, OECD says. Global economic output could decline by 1.5% over the rest of the century because of disruptions to schooling caused by COVID-19, according to a new estimate from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. In the United States, that might mean a total economic loss equivalent to $15.3 trillion, the OECD estimated in a report released Tuesday. And it could get worse if disruptions to schooling end up going on for longer. These estimates assume that only the cohort currently in school are affected by the closures and that all subsequent cohorts resume normal schooling. If schools are slow to return to prior levels of performance, the growth losses will be proportionately higher, the OECD said. Most OECD and partner countries have implemented nationwide school closures at some point during the pandemic, with the majority lasting at least 10 weeks. Though teachers, students, and their families have made efforts to mitigate the effects of such closures, the more marginalized groups who don't have access to digital learning resources or lack the resilience and engagement to learn on their own are at risk of falling behind, the report said. The report stops short of recommending reopening schools and universities, however. Reopening schools and universities will bring unquestionable benefits to students and the wider economy, the report states, but the potential benefits need to be considered in line with the public health risks. As public funds are directed to health and social welfare, long-term public spending on education is at a risk, despite short-term stimulus packages in some countries, it continues. Private funding will also become scarce as the economy weakens and unemployment rises. Now here's an article from yesterday's Midland Reporter-Telegram about how coronavirus has possibly changed the workforce permanently. Home may continue to be workplace after coronavirus. Like many people, John Coleman is working from home, and he's outfitted better than most. A sales manager for AmeriSave Mortgage Company in Plano, he has an upstairs office in his Frisco condo with a big computer, three monitors, and plenty of privacy. Downstairs, he has a 49-inch screen to keep an eye on mortgage work while enjoying time with his one-year-old son. "It's amazing how I get to watch him grow up," Coleman said. He misses the camaraderie and energy of the office, and after COVID-19 gets under control, he'd like to return to seeing everybody in person, but no more than a few days a week, if that. "Because of where I am in life with my family and son, I definitely prefer working from home," said Coleman, who's 30. "We love all this additional time together." Welcome to the new future of work. The pandemic that has caused so much pain and suffering has also accelerated a revolution in remote working, and some changes appear likely to stay after the public health crisis fades. Before the pandemic, about 8% of employees were working from home, according to a survey of Texas business executives by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. In August, when the poll was taken, that share was up to 35%. Perhaps most telling, respondents said they expected over 20% of employees to continue working remotely after the pandemic. "This genie will not be going back into the bottle quietly when the world gets past COVID-19, and that is a good thing in many respects," said one unnamed executive who acknowledged having misgivings initially. In May, according to a Stanford study, 42% of people were working from home, including many in high-paying positions. When including their earnings, remote workers accounted for more than two-thirds of economic activity, the study said. "Right now, there are more people working at home than working at work," Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom said last month at an event with the San Francisco Fed. Bloom and others have cited various problems. Fewer minorities hold remote jobs, which tilt heavily toward the college-educated. Only about half of Americans have an extra room for an office, and the majority have children at home, which can make it hard to focus. Bloom also worries about loyalty, motivation, and creativity, at least among those who are remote all the time. "Can you create new ideas if you're permanently working from home?" Bloom said. Employees are divided over the issue, with large shares wanting to come into the office all the time or not at all. But the greatest number prefer a hybrid approach, which includes working in both the office and home. That's how Allison Harding and her six associates are doing it. "When we meet in person, there's just more creativity. I don't know why," said Harding, director of career and financial services at Jewish Family Service of Greater Dallas. "We like being able to look people in the eye and do something spur of the moment. But I like being at home a couple of days a week, too." In the Dallas Fed survey, a majority of Texas executives said remote work had no impact on productivity. But almost 30% said it decreased productivity, three times more than those reporting an increase. "Collaboration is key to productivity," one executive told the Dallas Fed. "It just doesn't happen as often when the team is remote." AmeriSave Mortgage, which has everyone working remotely during COVID, has a different take. "It has had no problems with efficiency, focus, or productivity," said Al Murad, senior vice president for the Dallas-Fort Worth area. "Believe it or not, people are working more hours than when they were in the office, and it's voluntary," Murad said. When the Plano office reopens, he expects most people to still work from home. AmeriSave added 24 remote servers to provide faster access to data and technology. It's been recruiting nationwide, often leading with work-from-home offers. It also set a higher GPA, at least 3.0, for new candidates, and Murad said applications are pouring in. "We don't see any downside," Murad said about working from home. "I think this is here to stay." That's already the case at Bottle Rocket, a local firm best known for creating mobile apps and websites for well-known brands. In May, Bottle Rocket adopted a new approach called Work From Anywhere, which can range from Starbucks to an RV, to the company's cool headquarters in Addison. Productivity and employee satisfaction are up, said Calvin Carter, founder and CEO. Eliminating commutes and other traffic headaches save at least 5 hours a week for most employees. And we estimate that 30% to 50% of this newly found time is being contributed back to the business in billable hours, Carter said. So that's really working out for us. Work from everywhere is a competitive advantage in recruiting, he said, and it's also become one of the most favored benefits, rivaling vacation time. You send a very strong, positive message of trust and respect when you give employees the autonomy to decide where they're going to work today, tomorrow, and next week, Carter said. His biggest concern is how to develop cultural connections with new hires. Tenured employees are remaining connected through virtual happy hours, cooking lessons, and other online tools. But there's a disparity between legacy and new workers, which must be addressed. Do we change orientation? Set people up with mentors? Do more one-on-one meetings? Carter said. There may be no way to replace relationships that develop organically when colleagues meet at work and strike up a conversation. After Bottle Rocket reopens the headquarters, it may require new hires to spend 3 months or so at the mothership. We want people to experience the office in case that's where they can do the best work of their life, Carter said. Finally today, we have one pre-recorded report. This is from NPR. But Do I Love You? Tips for Homebound Declutterers.
With so many people spending a lot more time at home during the pandemic, there's plenty of time to reconsider all the stuff we accumulate in our houses and apartments. You know, that closet that won't close, that pile of papers that needs filing, maybe even an elderly parent's house that you know needs some attention. We called Julie Hall to get some tips on how to declutter. She is the director of the American Society of Estate Liquidators, and she's got a new book out called Inheriting Clutter. Hall says the COVID-19 related lockdowns have been a catalyst for house cleanings.
And so one of the biggest problems with that is, what do you do with all the stuff? Because we've accumulated it not only for ourselves, but from previous generations. So right now we're definitely seeing an uptick in this particular trend.
And Hall says different generations tend to have trouble parting with different sorts of things.
For example, our Depression era generation, their problem seems to be paper. They really didn't trust a lot of people, so they have receipts from, you know, the 1940s, and they've kept everything that you can imagine, catalogs, magazines, and it is time to let some of those things go and begin the thinning out process. For other generations, I'm a boomer, and I think the pain point for my generation is we have an emotional pull. We feel an obligation to our parents and these items that they cherish so much. But then our children, they don't want these items. So truly, we are the sandwich because we don't know what to do.
Hall says in her experience, millennials tend to have a more straightforward relationship with clutter. They don't want any. Still, she has this advice for people of all ages. Start with the easy stuff, like getting rid of that pile of old magazines in the corner.
Or let's step into the kitchen for a moment, where under the sink is an ice cream maker from circa 1962 that hasn't worked since 1963. And, you know, we've got the Cool Whip containers and the pie tins and the mayonnaise jars. Okay, I understand that that generation wanted to use those things, but they don't need to fill up the cabinets. I think in one kitchen, we counted 93 water glasses. And you just don't need that. So that's a great place to start, too.
Can I ask you, again, like I said, it's a more complex topic than it maybe it seems on the surface, because stuff isn't just stuff to people, right? Their stuff isn't just stuff. How do you handle the emotions that people go through when it comes to parting with stuff?
Well, I've had to go through this personally. You know, I became a widow quite suddenly. So I lost my parents suddenly. So I had to learn how to do this myself. And, you know, the emotional part, I think that sorting through items is very healing when someone's grieving. And I think it's really important, whether you're not grieving, in a way, it's still grief because it's your life and you're letting go of a lot of these things and you're welcoming in a new chapter. So for me, the key has always been to make peace with the items I'm letting go of. And I hold it and I look at it and I say, do I like you? Yes, I do. But do I love you? No, I don't. And if I don't absolutely love it and cherish it, I take a picture of it and I let it go.
Decluttering tips from Julie Hall. She is the author of Inheriting Clutter.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. Coming up next, we'll bring you USA Today with national news. And then local news at 3 o'clock. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading. We're going to start back with the weekend's newspapers, Saturday and Sunday, and try to read as many of the time-sensitive articles as we can, and then bring you the feature articles, such as opinion columns, later in the week. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service seeks to deny some habitat protections. Autopsy shows inmate swallows plastic bag. Council and manager to decide on separation agreement. Reports. Lee makes naming committee's list of five. Poll shows first-time gun buyers fear civil unrest. Lawyers seek new trial for death row inmate. Marquez seeks another term in MISD District 2. National Weather Service says cooler temperatures and rain on the way. Now here are articles from the Odessa American, beginning with Saturday's front page. State Board to Tackle Sex Ed Standards. At-large Odessa City Council. Gentry running for at-large. Lawyer says, we're taking the baton Bland gave us. Protesters gather following excessive force comments. COVID grants still available. Apolinario seeks Odessa's top spot. Mata looking to District 1 seat. Those are some of the local articles our volunteers will be reading this afternoon, beginning at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 89 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This is Sister Eileen Bielman reporting from USA Today, Tuesday, September 8, 2020. More officers may die of COVID-19 than from 9/11. The line of duty deaths so far this year have exceeded all of 19. Sheila Byron Lagatuta, chief of police in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, wasn't shocked to learn of the bold new killers stalking law enforcement officers across the nation. Scores of law enforcement officials, from beat officers and detectives to Border Patrol agents and prison guards, have died of COVID-19. The Officer Down Memorial page, a nonprofit organization dedicated to honoring fallen officers, lists more than 100 who lost their lives to the virus. Spokeswoman Jessica Rushing said her organization has about 150 more such fatalities awaiting formal verification. In Glen Ridge, Officer Charles Roberts, praised by his peers as the face of the police department, who had a smile for everyone, died in May. Byron Lagatuta was among several other officers and